Meeting of the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee. For the record, today is Tuesday, March 18th, 2008. We're all here together in the Belts Room in the State Capitol in Juneau, and senators present are Senators Davis, Ellis, Stevens, and Hoffman. Appreciate you all being with us today, and we're beginning the meeting about 5 minutes after 2 in the afternoon. The game plan today is to first take up Senate Bill 297. That's the public employee salary and benefits. This bill has a further referral to the Finance Committee. We've heard it several times. We adopted a committee substitute at the last meeting, and I will solicit action on final disposition of that bill here in a few moments. That will be followed by House Bill 65, the Personal Information and Consumer Credit. I announced at our last meeting Saturday that today would be D-Day, or should I say ID Day. The Identity Theft Bill, I hope it will be the will of the committee to move that on to the Judiciary Committee, and it still has to go to Finance as well. Then we're going to take up first hearings on Senate Bill 263 by Senator Thomas, Architects, Engineers, Surveyors, Board Exemption. We have several people to testify, but that should be relatively quick legislation, followed by Senator Davis's Senate Bill 179, Dependent Health Insurance Age Limit. So that's the game plan for today. It's a full plate. We hope to get through this as expeditiously as possible. So if we could each take up our folder for Senate Bill 297. I called several times for discussion at the last hearing, and if there's any discussion today, happy to hear that. Or the chair will enter. If there's not, the chair will entertain a motion to move the bill on to the Finance Committee. Senate Bill 297. Senator Stevens.
Mr. Chairman, Section 20 is still in here, right?
Correct. That was in the committee substitute that was adopted.
If I can speak to that.
Certainly.
My concern with that is that it just seems to me like it's beyond the regular collective bargaining process when if you can't get something in collective bargaining, then you take it to the legislature and bypass the collective bargaining system. So it seems to me that this still should not be in here, and because of that, I'm concerned about it.
Okay. Thank you. And I'd note for the record that Senator Bundy has joined us. Senator Davis, would you consider making a motion for me to move the bill, and then we can have a discussion on that motion?
I move that we move Senate
Bill 297.
297, but it's not the original bill, right?
It's the committee substitute.
Yeah. To move it from the committee with individual recommendations and attach the notes.
Okay. The bill does go on to Finance, where I'm sure the debate will continue about all the pieces of the bill, including the one that Senator Stevens mentioned. Is there discussion of the motion? Is there opposition to the motion to move the bill?
I'll object.
Senator Bundy, do you care to speak to your motion?
Well, again, and I would just echo Senator Stevens' comments, I would consider this a fairly labor-friendly labor and commerce committee where labor and commerce issues ought to be addressed without the backup of finance. You're setting a precedent that an unfriendly labor and commerce committee could revise collective bargaining issues, perhaps, and if they can't, then it's really unfair abuse of the process that you don't get what you want in bargaining. You go to the legislature and do an end run. If you bargain for something, I suppose the legislature can just choose, as they have in the past, not to fund it. But it's not a good precedent, and I oppose the moving the bill forward as it is.
Okay. Thank you, Senator Bundy. I stated at the last hearing that I thought this was a conversation starter, and the conversation has been engaged, and I expect will continue. I don't think it would surprise anyone if there were changes made as the bill moves on through the process. Any further discussion? There is objection to the motion to move the bill. Could we proceed to a roll call vote, please?
Senator Hoffman?
Yes.
Senator Bundy?
No.
Senator Davis?
Yes.
Senator Stevens?
No.
Senator Ellis?
Yes. Okay, so thank you very much. The bill moves on to the next committee of referral for further consideration. Let's turn now to the Identity Theft Bill, House Bill 65. That bill has a further referral to the Judiciary and Finance Committees. We've had a number of overviews, walkthroughs, markups. work sessions on this piece of legislation, and we need to make a final disposition of the bill, get it in the best shape we can, and move it on for further consideration by those other two standing committees. So that's the game plan for today. Ms. Litzer, welcome back to the table. Ms. Foster as well. We need to clear up any of the outstanding issues. I would note for the committee members that we did receive some correspondence from Yahoo relating to a section of the bill, and Representative Coghill was under the impression that maybe that concern had been addressed in the CS. We're informed that that's not the case, and had asked for some drafting to be done. Ms. Bannister is working very hard, earning her pay again this session, but we may not have that amendment for consideration today, so that would be punted onto the Judiciary Committee once we receive it. But if you all want to take us through some of the outstanding issues, and we'll proceed.
All right. Thank you. My name is Karen Litzer, for the record, and I am staff to Representative John Coghill. And I hope before you have a very clear sectional that helps you go through the changes that we have made to the CS for House Bill 65 version N, as in Nancy, and the issues that we took up on Saturday. As Senator Ellis said, we thought that we had taken care of the notification issue with internet agencies like Yahoo and Amazon.com, and Representative Coghill is favorable to looking at making sure that we do address those issues. And I have spoken with your committee aide, and we are expecting the amendment in. But let's go through the sectional, and if we could turn to the security freeze authorized, and that is page 7, line 5. In talking with actually the individuals from Choice Point and LexisNexis, it was made clear to us that in a security freeze, you cannot freeze a portion of your credit information. In the version O that we looked at, it said that they would freeze all or a part of, and we have removed the words all or a part of. It is just to clearly reflect that when you put a freeze on your credit information, it is all frozen, all of that information. On page 15, line 7, in reading through the
entire... Line 7 or line 17?
I'm sorry, excuse me, sir, line 17.
Okay.
Thank you. In reading through the subject of exemptions for correct wording in subparagraph 10, we removed consumer credit reporting agency. They do not use a credit report. It needed to be a person. It was just a wordsmithing and an error that needed to be corrected. On page 16, line 17, again, we go back to the confusion with the security freeze as far as to clarify that, and we have removed all or a part of, again, to reflect the fact that if a consumer decides to freeze their credit report, they do freeze all of that credit information. On page 17, lines 21 and 22, initially we had addressed the concerns of the Department of Natural Resources, specifically the recording district, in trying to make sure that the employees that are doing their job accepting documents for recording and then giving a copy out of a document that had previously been recorded, they were not put in a position of possibly disclosing information that our bill would be saying you cannot. In doing so, there was just a clearer way to write the use of the Social Security number. And so on page 17, lines 21 and 22, we removed the words request or collect and inserted communicate or otherwise make available to the general public. And in subparagraph 2, which is the same page 17, line 23, again, it just clarifies what those employees would be doing, and we inserted communicating or otherwise making available, which clarifies any of the job duties that they may be performing that relates to a recorded document.
And so, Ms. Lidster, again, this DNR requested this, and their private sector people that are very concerned were concerned about the original language that's being amended here. This language is applicable more broadly than just DNR, though. Or is it?
The information could probably be used in another sector. We did get the request specifically by DNR that we had initially given that provision to them to be able to disclose the information. They thought that it would just make it tighter and clearer to also have it in that portion of the use of the Social Security number.
Okay. So DNR is happy. They've seen this language, and they're happy, satisfied. So the private sector folks who depend on that DNR recording function are satisfied, to your knowledge?
Absolutely, sir.
Okay. And we can take questions as we move along. We want to clear up any committee concerns point by point, so feel free to let us know if you have questions. But please proceed.
Move on? Okay, thank you. If we can turn to Section 4548.410, which is in the section related to the Social Security number, and that will be on page 18, lines 11 through 15. When we spoke with the folks at Choice Point and LexisNexis, there has, of course, been their concern that the wording in the bill was going to prevent them from doing the type of work and providing the information that they believed they were allowed to do under the federal regulations, the GLBA and the FCRA. In our conversations with them, we came up with the language that you see as far as the new subparagraph 3 and subparagraph 4 that specifically relates to the Gramm-Leach-Bliley Financial Modernization Act and the Fair Credit Reporting Act. In the three sections that we have, that is the request and collection, the sale, lease, loan, and trade, and the disclosure, which is all part of the Social Security article, which is, of course, a very important and very, it's that we are trying to regulate the most to protect the, you know, the Alaska residents, has been where we have tried to make sure that we do not stop industry from doing what they need to do that actually serves the consumer, but that we don't put the consumers unnecessarily in some type of free flow of their, you know, Social Security number. We have been back in contact with LexisNexis and Choice Point, and I know that there are still some concerns that they have with the way we have worded these three sections that relate specifically to the Social Security number. As you heard on Saturday, Representative Coghill felt that he had made significant concessions in these areas. I think he used the term he had given his pound of flesh, but in speaking with their representatives, it looks like there might be one or two small words in the way we have worded this that can still fix what they have as a problem and still keep Representative Coghill at the position that he feels is protecting those that are not regulated by the GLBA or the FCRA, but still not stop the help and the types of advantages of credit reports and consumer reports that the consumers actually desire. So
Ms. Lidster, are you saying the language here strikes that balance, or are you saying there's more work to be done?
Well, we think that it strikes the balance as far as in giving any more, bringing down any further sidebars to what we have. Mm-hmm. And as you see, it talks about a person regulated by the Gramm-Leach-Bliley Financial Modernization Act. In some cases, there just still seems to be a concern and then it says for a purpose authorized. So I have spoken with their representatives, and as Representative Cockillard said, it does not appear that it's dropping down any further sideboards for protection of the consumer, but it will have to be looked at. So where we are right now with these provisions and the changes that we have made is where the representative feels is a good balance.
Okay, so Ms. Bannister drafted this. Did Mr. Sniffen participate in some of this drafting or thoughts about it?
Mr. Chairman, yes, he did, and I expect that he is still, he is possibly online. I know he had another committee to testify at, but he may be online at this time.
He is. And were you finished then with, was there a little bit more to go there on your sheet?
Just a little, and I guess I tried to put the sections 45, 48, 410, and 420 together. Hopefully it doesn't confuse you because the Social Security number is such an important part. But if you look at page 18, line 29 through 31, you'll see that it is a new subsection 2, and it talks about the person regulated by the Graham-Leach-Bliley Financial Modernization Act for a purpose authorized by that act. And then on page 19, we have the new subsection 3 that then states that it is a person regulated by the Fair Credit Reporting Act. If you go into down further onto page 19, under the disclosure section of the Social Security, it talks about the third party that is regulated by the FCRA. We did not add in the Graham-Leach-Bliley because that was in subparagraph 3.
Okay, Ms. Lidster, thank you. Ms. Foster, do you have any quick comment before we turn to Mr. Sniffen?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Megan Foster with Representative Lascara's office. Our office has been working hand in hand with Representative Coghill, and we're comfortable with the changes that are going to be made.
Okay. Okay, so we're in the process. That was the run through of the proposed committee substitute. That's Bannister 317.08/N. We're going to take some more comments before we get to considering that. Mr. Sniffen, are you there?
I am, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
Do you have any comments on the, you know, we're trying to make as much progress as we can before the bill moves on to judiciary. Do you have any comments on the sectional we've just walked through, and in particular that last portion?
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Again, Ed Sniffen with the Department of Law. I have spoken with Representative Coghill and Ms. Lidster about those changes, and I agree with all of them, and I think they do strike a good balance between allowing industry to do what they need to do, but then protecting consumers as well, and we certainly support them.
Okay, any questions for Mr. Sniffen? If not, Ed, thank you for your review of the proposed committee substitute.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
Okay, let's go to Audrey Robinson online, and then following Audrey or Ms. Robinson to Mr. John Burton.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, this is Audrey Robinson representing Reed Elsevier, the parent company of LexisNexis. I have been able to briefly review the latest changes to the CS that is before you. We appreciate working with the co-sponsors, Gara and Coghill, and their staff, and appreciate the attempt to allow for legitimate business use of Social Security numbers. I think we've come a long way to allowing that to happen. I think that unfortunately, it might just be a one or two word issue, but the exemptions don't quite get to our uses. Unfortunately, the Graham-Leach-Bliley Act refers to financial institutions, and that is particularly who is regulated by that act. However, use of Social Security numbers falls within the purview of that act, and so while we are compliant with GLBA, we aren't technically regulated by GLBA. Our uses are. So it's an issue where misuse would still fall within the boundaries of the FTC to prosecute us. So, you know, you're falling within the purview of the federal law still, but unfortunately, without with that kind of conjunctive language that's used in the bill, that you have to both be regulated by and purposes regulated by. That's kind of the rub right there. So it could be as easy as, you know, simply an and to an or kind of a fix. But we're still looking to work on that so that we can get the appropriate appropriate amendments so that we can use this information for the uses that Alaskans would hope that we could continue for fraud prevention, asset location, location of missing children, checking to make sure that the person opening a bank account isn't a terrorist. So, again, I think we're close. We're getting closer, and we appreciate the work. Just the one thing that I would like to mention as well is on page 19 of the work draft in front of you, beginning on line 28, the subparagraph 3, it's actually the former GLB language that was changed in 410 and 420. So I would just ask that for conformity purposes that be changed to reflect the newer language that's in the other sections. And I think that concludes my remarks. Thank you.
Ms. Robinson, thank you for your participation. You've helped us
thank you.
In our committee deliberations. Is there agreement from the sponsor staff that updating is a wise thing to do, what Ms. Robinson just mentioned?
Mr. Chairman, that would be no problem. It would conform with the rest of the language that we had agreed to in the other sections that deal with the Social Security number. I do not see any reason that it would not be an appropriate change.
Okay. We're making more progress and improvement. The chair will entertain a conceptual amendment to update. Well, actually, we need to adopt the committee substitute first. So let's hold that in abeyance, or I don't know what the correct words are, but let's just hold off on that, and we'll come back to it, because it sounds like we have agreement on that. We have a little bit more public testimony to take before we get to considering the committee substitute. So Mr. Burton, and then following Mr. Burton's testimony, we'll have Gail Hillebrand, and then we'll need to move into the action phase. Mr. Burton, are you there?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is John Burton here again today on behalf of ChoicePoint. And I will keep my remarks brief and basically would say that I echo the comments and concerns that have been expressed by my colleague at LexisNexis. And I just want to kind of reiterate that I do take great encouragement that the sponsors and certainly this committee and the Attorney General's office at least recognize and are sensitive to the existence of issues with existing federal statutes like Gramm-Leach-Bliley and the SCRA and the DPPA and others. And so we're committed to continuing to work with the sponsors that they will work with us to reaching a solution. Additionally, although I do want to say that the other issue that remains outstanding is the expressly versus not expressly. That is still a significant issue for us, but I'm confident, again, that we are going to do everything on our end to try to work within the framework that the sponsors have set up and from comments from the Attorney General's office and this committee as well to reaching a solution there. But so that's where we are today. We still have some concerns, but we're committed to hammering this rock as long as it takes to get where we need to be.
Thank you, Mr. Burton. You've helped us in our deliberations. We appreciate that. Gail Hillebrand.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. We're pleased to support HB 65. The change that was referred to on page 19, I believe, is a purely technical change, and we do not have any objection to it. With respect to the concept of these broader exemptions that are already in the CS, they are substantially broader than what was brought to you before, but they do retain the integrity of saying that there's not a free pass from federal law if federal law really doesn't govern the conduct. Instead, it's when federal law both authorizes conduct and regulates the people who engage in it that there would be the state law would defer to federal law. And we think that's a reasonable place to draw that line. Thank you.
Ms. Hillebrand, thank you for the participation of Consumers Union in these committee deliberations. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Okay. I guess at this time, Mr. Owen, we do have an amendment back from Terry Bannister relating to the Yahoo issue. for lack of a better term. So we need to distribute that. Let's go ahead and pass that out. And to the sponsor's staff as well. Okay. So we're going to, I'm going to propose action to adopt the committee substitute here in just a moment, the Bannister 317-08/N. And then we will consider two amendments, the Yahoo amendment that's been passed out here in writing, and then the technical amendment, the Robinson suggestion on page 19, updating that reference, which the committee's or the sponsors' representatives have agreed to. So at this time, the chair will entertain a motion to adopt the proposed committee substitute, the /N version.
So moved, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Senator Stevens has moved the proposed committee substitute. Is there discussion of the motion? Is there any objection to the motion? Hearing none, that is adopted as the item before us. Now let's move to markup then. We will call the written amendment, the Yahoo amendment, amendment number one. And Mr. Owen, could you come to the table and just explain Yahoo's, they were speaking for a consortium of other electronic, a number of other business entities. Could you speak to their concern, their request briefly?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I'm Dana Owen, staff to Senator Ellis. Their concern was that there were some members of their coalition who communicate with their clients strictly by email. And what this amendment would do is allow one of those businesses, if they have a primary communication means by electronic means, that they would be able to notify that client or that customer of a breach of security information via electronic means.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Owen. Any questions or comments? If not, I will move amendment number one, and we will ask the sponsors' representatives to come back and just give their thought, hopefully their blessing.
Mr. Chairman, this is Karen Litzch again, staff to Representative John Coghill. And Representative Coghill and I had discussed this, and he was agreeable to making it clearer that if the collector's primary method of communication was by electronic means. We had felt on Saturday when we discussed this before that we had taken care of that, but by language that was already in the bill, this is when business may already have both, but the primary communication is electronically, and so Representative Coghill would support this amendment.
Okay. So this is a reasonable, business-friendly, electronic age kind of change in this legislation?
Yes, sir.
Okay. The amendment's before us. Is there any objection to adoption of amendment number one? Hearing none, that is adopted. Okay, let's proceed then to what I will call amendment number two. That's the Robinson technical suggestion on page 19, updating that reference. Is it only on page 19 that that's required? Ms. Litzer?
Yes. Mr. Chairman, yes, that is the only reference where it is the old language that was left in the bill, the new
okay.
version.
So we will adopt that as a technical amendment, or I will move amendment number two. Is there any further discussion of amendment number two? Is there any objection to adoption of amendment number two? Hearing none, so ordered. Okay, I think that those are the outstanding issues which I was aware for a potential markup. Is there any other thoughts by members of the committee? Public testimony was officially closed, but we've heard some public testimony from folks about who are most impacted about the proposed committee substitute. I think we've done some good work here together, and I appreciate everyone working together to try and understand each other and improve the work product. Is there any further discussion of the identity theft legislation? The chair at this time then, have we covered all the bases, Dana?
I think so.
Okay. I think we have, and hopefully we're on to judiciary and then finance. The chair at this time will entertain a motion to move the amended bill forward.
Mr. Chairman, I move we move CS for CSR House Bill 65/N forward with the attached fiscal note and notes and individual recommendations.
Okay. Thank you for the motion. Is there discussion of the motion? Any objection to the motion? Hearing none, so ordered. The bill moves on to the next committee referral. Thank you both very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank
and
you.
All the
Thank
participants. Okay, let's move on with the rest of our work today. Which would be Senate Bill 263 by Senator Joe Thomas. This is relating to architects, engineers, surveyors, board exemption. There is no further referral. We are the only committee of consideration for this bill, and there is a proposed committee substitute. Are they on their way?
They were here just a moment ago. I'll track them down.
Okay.
Did you mention to the members that there's a new set of backup documents in there?
Okay. Senator Thomas, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
If you want to join us at the table there.
Certainly.
While you're coming forward, I want to note for members in your packets, there's a new set of backup for this piece of legislation that better reflects the proposed committee substitute that will be considered offered today. Senator Thomas, good afternoon. The bill is before us. If you'd like to state your name again for the record, and please go ahead with your initial presentation of the legislation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and rest of the committee. Senator Joe Thomas, District D. Senate Bill 263 is a relatively simple bill, as most are. This one even simpler. It assists the functioning of the Board of Architects, Engineers, and Land Surveyors by making two modest changes to existing statute. First, the bill allows the governor to appoint a petroleum or chemical engineer to the board if a mining engineer is not available to serve. In the past, there's been some problems with that, so they've had to leave the space vacant in some cases. So this takes care of that, but it does allow that when a vacancy becomes available, it will always be offered first to the petroleum or to the mining engineer. The board has 10 members, 2 civil engineers, 1 mining engineer, that's the seat we're talking about, 1 electrical or mechanical engineer, 1 engineer from another branch of engineering, as well as 2 architects, 2 land surveyors, and 1 public member. Board members must have been registered voters in Alaska before the last general election. Only 22 of Alaska's 4,000 registered engineers are resident mining engineers, which can make it difficult to find qualified and interested candidates. Therein lays the problem. In your packet is a list of engineering specialties, the board licenses, and the number of license holders. The second section of SB 263 adds the underlying language on page 4 to the list of exemptions from the licensing laws. This language is different from the draft CS that I have offered for your consideration than it was in the original bill. CSSB 263 exempts persons who design fire detection or suppression systems from the engineering licensing laws. If they are authorized to design fire detection or suppression systems by the Alaska Department of Public Safety, which is basically what has been taking place. This provision solidifies in statute the current industry practice and has the support of both the board and the Department of Public Safety Fire Marshal's Office. The public safety regulations governing the permitting of the individuals to design fire detection or suppression systems and the number of people who hold those permits are in your packet. Assistant Fire Marshal Kelly Nicolello is online to answer questions about the permitting process, should you have any. And I ask for your support of the legislation.
Okay, Senator Thomas, thank you for being here. Any questions or comments at this stage? If not, let's proceed on then with public testimony, which is now open on the bill, and we'll begin with Mr. Mark Morris. Mr. Morris? Okay, maybe we'll get Mr. Morris here in a moment. Let's move on to Craig Fredin, who I believe is online.
Should be.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman and Senators. Just to let you know, I believe Mark Morris is out of town today.
Okay.
But,
Mr. Fredin, if you
Craig
could give...
Fredin.
Yep.
I am the mechanical engineer on the Architect, Engineer, and Land Surveyor Board, as well as an associate member of the Alaska Professional Design Council. Excuse me. I would like to speak in favor of the bill, as well as the committee substitute. This is a little history, brief history on this. Our regulations for licensing of engineers basically says if you're doing design work, you have to be a licensed engineer. There is in existence a another set of state-given permits for very well-qualified individuals to do fire protection design, and that's the ones given out from public safety. The board is very comfortable with the professionalism and the knowledge of these individuals with these permits, but reading through our statutes, the exemption to this design requirement is kind of vague, and there is a concern that a future board who may not know as much about this these individuals may feel that they are in violation of the design regulations and statutes. So we wanted to solidify it and get it in statute that their permit is recognized and will not get them in trouble with our board's investigators. Speaking to the first portion of the bill, we are also very much in favor. Senator Thomas spoke very well to the reasons behind the first portion of the bill. We believe that this was just something that we should get down on record, and we appreciate your support.
Thank you, Mr. Ferdin. We appreciate you being with us today. Let's move on to Mr. Kelly Nicolelo online. Are you there, sir?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Kelly Nicolelo. I'm the Assistant State Fire Marshal for the Department of Public Safety. We would urge your support for CSSB 263, the reasons as stated by Senator Thomas and by Mr. Ferdin. And all three of us have worked closely on this CS, and we think it's a good way to meet their requirements and still maintain ours without stepping on anybody's toes or anything else. And plus, we also are going to be working together for future requirements for design professionals in the future. So this actually has worked well to our benefit to be able to come together kind of in a team format and be able to deal with this from a design basis. I'd be happy to entertain any questions that you might have this afternoon.
Thank you, sir. Are there any questions from committee members? Seeing none, let's move on to Mr. Pat Thompson. Mr. Thompson, are you with us?
Hello, I'm here.
Yes, sir. Go ahead and give your name and affiliation for the record and go ahead.
Thank you, sir. My name is Patrick Thompson, Simplex Grinnell, and thank you for the opportunity to voice an opinion here on the bill that's presented. I'm one of the design professionals mentioned by the previous people here, and I've watched this bill progress to the stage that it's at now. I feel that at the stage it's at now, it's at a stage that I would support, and probably most of the people in my community would support with the way it's drafted. I know that there is a push by the AELS board to up the standards, if you will, for the design of fire protection systems. I personally do support that movement and would continue to work to make that happen. And I appreciate the way that it's worded right now in this draft from the committee, and would voice my opinion to have this pass through and be enacted appropriately. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Thompson. We appreciate you being here. Those are the only folks that I have signed up to testify. There are other folks who signed in but are a no on testimony. Is there anyone else here in the room or online who would like to give comment at this time? Hearing none, let's turn to the proposed committee substitute that's in committee members' packets. This is the Bullard 310-08/C version. And Senator Thomas, if you could just remind us, my understanding from committee staff is that there was it deletes one line there at the end on page 4. Do you want to speak briefly to the committee substitute?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yes, that's exactly what takes place. It removes on page 4 lines 7, 8, and 9, which read before, certified by National Institute for Certification in Engineering Technologies Design Fire Detection or Suppression Systems and authorized. Left in that part. I shouldn't have said authorized. It took out just the part, the NICET certification, and allows only for those authorized by Department of Public Safety to design fire detection or suspension systems, which is the state's authorization. So we think that's important and more appropriate than some national certification.
Okay. Senator Bundy.
Thank you. Does the current Board of Engineers have a mining engineer as a participant?
I believe so.
Yes,
I believe there is one at this time, yes.
And that member has not expressed any opposition to your bill?
No, matter of fact, through the chair, no, I think that they're all in favor of this basically because there has been difficulty filling that position, so they're pleased. Everybody seems to be pleased anyhow with the concept that could be a chemical or a petroleum engineer taking that seat, but when that seat becomes available, they would be first offered to a mining engineer.
Mr. Chairman, I think you and I remember some time back from Donnybrook about petroleum engineers and what really constituted one. Has there been any opposition to this bill?
Not that I'm aware of. I haven't had anybody contact the office that I'm aware of.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, thank you, Senator Bundy. Okay, the chair will at this time, I mean, everyone knows it's our practice to hear bills, hold them over, think about them, make sure we do make the right decision. But I would like to get the committee substitute adopted today so that folks will have that out there as the public document, as the item before us for action in the near future at our next meeting. So the chair at this time will entertain a motion to adopt the Bullard/C committee substitute as the item before us.
So moved.
Thank you. Multiple motions that time. I appreciate it. There is a motion to adopt this committee substitute. Is there any discussion? Any objection? If not, so adopted. That is the item before us. Senator Thomas, any wrap-up words before we hold this over and have it back before us very soon?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. No, I don't have anything else to add to it. Like I said, relatively simple and appears to be at this point in time no objection to the bill. So I just appreciate your consideration and look forward to it moving forward in the next meeting.
Okay. We will have it back before us at our Thursday meeting for expeditious action.
Thank you very much.
Okay, let's turn now to Senate Bill 179, Dependent Health Insurance Age Limit, sponsored by Senator Davis. And the sponsor's representative is coming forward, Mr. Obermeier. Mr. Obermeier, good afternoon. We would want to take initial presentation today and any public testimony and then hold over the bill for further consideration. So please identify yourself for the record and go right ahead.
Senator Ellis and committee, Tom Obermeier, aide to Senator Davis. The bill before you today is Senate Bill 179. It's 25LS0936/C. It's an act requiring family health care insurance coverage for dependent children who are less than 26 years of age. The bill itself, you'll notice, is a one-line statement, a one-sentence statement that says under Alaska Statute 2142.345 that a health care insurer who provides health care insurance coverage of a child through family health care insurance may not deny enrollment and may not disenroll or eliminate coverage for a dependent child of the insured who is less than 26 years of age. The this bill then requires that the family health care insurance for dependents continue up to age 26. Young adults ages 19 through 29 are one of the largest growing segments of the U.S. population without health care insurance. In 2004, almost 14 million young adults lacked coverage, and an increase of 2.5 million since 2000. The rapid change is due in part to their losing coverage under their parents' policies at age 19, or Medicaid, or state children's health insurance program, or graduation from high school or college. Almost half of the college graduates and high school graduates who do not go to college will be uninsured for a substantial time after graduation. Age 19 is a crucial year in health insurance coverage. Both public and private insurance plans treat this age as a turning point for insurance coverage. If not in school full-time, but perhaps still at home, they're often dropped at age 19. Even if youth go on to college, parents' insurance plans often stop before graduation. Almost all private universities and about a fourth of public universities require health insurance as a condition of enrollment. But that's an additional cost to the family because it usually costs between $500 to $2,400 a year additionally for each student. 40% of part-time students and non-students and 20% of full-time students aged 19 through 23 are uninsured. There's need for coverage for young adults 18 to 29 for many other reasons besides being students. It's been documented that 14% of adults 18 to 29 are obese, an increase of 70% in the 90s. There are 3.5 million pregnancies each year among the 21 million women ages 19 to 29. One-third of all diagnoses of HIV are made among young adults. Emergency room visits are far more common among young adults than children or older adults. And most young adults have no regular doctor, no link to health care system, and more than one-third of those who do require medical attention are often saddled with debt and collection agencies. States are taking action to mandate coverage for young adults, often allowing for targeted policy options. Note that the bill, while requiring coverage to age 26, does not dictate rates or adjusted rates to age 26, but it does avoid the situation of no coverage at all for these young people, or double coverage or loss of coverage when they go to college. In 2006, New Jersey, for example, required most group health plans to cover single adult dependents up to age 30. Massachusetts, as part of its expanded health insurance law in 2006, considered dependents for insurance purposes up to age 25 or for 2 years after they are no longer claimed on their parents' tax returns. Since 1994, Utah has required coverage through age 26, and New Mexico provided coverage for unmarried dependents up to age 25, regardless of school enrollment. Texas, a very large state with large population, in 2003 allowed full-time students to be covered by their parents' insurance plans to age 25. It's not uncommon or unreasonable, therefore, that Senate Bill 179 would require offering family health insurance coverage to dependent children up to age 26.
Okay, thank you for your presentation. Questions, Senator Bundy?
Is there a separate definition of dependent child for insurance purposes? I mean, when one is 21, they're emancipated. How do you define a dependent child?
Well, Mr. Oberman, through the chair, Senator Bundy, this essentially defines the dependent through, as I interpret it, through the after that is somebody that is still declared as a dependent by the parent who's paying for the parent. I mean, if you use the IRS definition, it would, as you probably are aware, it would require they're paying half of their costs, and they may be in their home, they may not if they're a student. What's happening, in my own observation, is that many young people who go off to college are dropped immediately by their on their plan if they're part time, or if they drop out for a period of time for a semester, they're all immediately off their plan. Most plans do require that parents in the student situation prove that their children are in college. They have to submit registration documentation and so forth. This is not just specifically for coverage, I think, of students, but you bring up a good point of dependent, but I think that is the definition of dependent is in each policy that you'll find, and that would be I'm sorry, the I don't believe the director of insurance is with us today or online. I did speak with her earlier. This question hadn't come up, but I am sure that that she'd be happy to answer this question.
Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Committee staff is noting that Ms. Hall was not available to participate in this meeting today. But Senator Bundy and then Senator Stevens.
Yeah, thank you. And that will be important, I think, for us to hear from her. You also mentioned that if these young people that would fall under the purview of this bill, their premiums could be quite expensive. Well, if we require this coverage, then would the parent be saddled with these expensive premiums? I mean, there may be some cost savings because they're in a group rather than individual, but we're going to mandate the an additional cost on parents, are we not?
Through the chair, Senator Bundy, it was noted in the fiscal note that the impact financially is indeterminate, that it's possible that, for example, because Medicaid is, for example, is a payer of last resort, this could result in the savings in the Medicaid program for children who are not currently covered by third-party insurance. However, these savings could be reduced, they say, if mandatory coverage of older dependent increases the cost of health insurance and leads employers or individuals to drop coverage. So there may be adjustments, but it has been my observation and reading of what the other states are doing that there can be adjustments to continue coverage if it's determined based on some data as demonstrated to the Division of Insurance that their costs would go up. One of the problems is that without a current history of the additional costs, there's no way to really predict what the amount or increase would be, if at all. For the most part, most of the college students are very healthy people and require very little attention, but there are occurrences when they do need medical care, and this would help solve that problem without burdening, for example, the family with a $2,400 policy just for that one child.
If I might, Mr. Chairman, we may be talking about two different things. I could see the some of it had there was a state employee and had this group health policy, but a parent who wasn't a state employee and just wanted to buy health insurance for their family will indeed then be faced with higher premiums because of this expanded coverage.
Through the chair, Senator Bundy, I suspect that's true. It may be still cheaper than providing double coverage for both, or that child not having any coverage at all, which seems to be a great a great portion of the young people out there. They just drop out of the system hoping that they're healthy enough that they're not going to have a problem.
Yeah, thank you.
Senator Stevens?
Yeah, I think my question was answered. Thank you.
Okay. Anything further, Mr. Obermeyer?
No, sir. That's
okay. And is there anyone else online or here in the room who would like to testify at this time on the bill? If not, we will have the bill back before us, and there's been a request for Ms. Hall to join us at that time and weigh in on the issue. The bill does have a further referral to the HES Committee and the Finance Committee. So if there's no one else to testify today, and no further business to come before us at this time, we appreciate you being here, and we are adjourned.